This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM, and this is Arab Talk with Jess and Jamal. I'm Jess Hanan.
And this is Jamal Dajani.
Well, Jamal, where shall we start? We have extrajudicial assassinations, we have capsized boats, and we have another black man brutally murdered in the United States.
And we have your trip to Cuba, where we're going to talk about this later on. But also we have actually about many more stories to update our listeners here. The Yemen conflict still goes on. Saudi Arabia launched a new airstrikes on the Houthis, and this is the Saudi-led coalition warplanes have struck Houthi rebels across Yemen in fresh raids. 2 days, I mean, this is the strange thing about it, 2 days after announcing the end of a month-long air campaign.
Well, they announced mission accomplished. They had done their air campaign. They felt like they had accomplished everything they wanted to, and 2 days later, they're right back at it.
Yeah, they basically said this was over, and then 2 days later, you're right, which tells me something, that their campaign was a failure.
Of course it was.
And from what we've seen in the media and the images that were transmitted all over the world of children in hospitals, of hospital being bombed, of schools being bombed, and civilians being attacked. A milk factory was destroyed on the assumption that it had ammunition in it. So maybe afterwards they got all the results and they found out that this has not affected the advancing Houthis.
Right. So the strategic, what the Saudis and the new Arab collective army have said, that the reason they're doing this is to bring stability to Yemen, to allow President Hadi to go back, and to restore stability in the region. So let's look at, have any of those things been accomplished,
nothing,
Jamal?
Nothing has been accomplished. And
more instability.
Hadi is not back, but according to reports from Yemen this morning, strikes were focused on in and around Aden. The targets reportedly included tanks being used by Houthi fighters in the southern port city. So that's their target. Two colleges used as bases, according to the media, Saudi media, that according to them, those colleges were used by rebels on the outskirts of Ilbib, and the nearby town of Yarem were also bombed, while a military base was hit in Al-Kafr. So, you know, they're back at it. Dozens of people have been reported killed or injured.
Including civilians.
Including civilians and members of the media basically have been targeted, according to reports from Yemen.
We also know, by the way, that a ship so-called – this has again been one of the big media complaints from the United States and Europe, because there's a ship allegedly coming from Iran – on its way headed to Yemen right now, they think, with arms that are trying to be smuggled into Yemen for the Houthis.
Yeah, and the United States has its navy to intercept it. I mean this was reported actually last week that the U.S. is placing some navy vessels to interrupt any flow of arms between Iran and Yemen. But listen to this. More than 150,000 people thus far have been displaced, and an estimated 2 million children are unable to attend school. So the schools are shut. The country's health system is also at imminent risk of collapse due to shortages of medical supplies and fuel for generators. And this is a report by the United Nations. Cases of measles, suspected malaria, etc. You know, when the hospitals and you don't have clean water, etc., you start having an outbreak. So now they're having, it looks like, on the verge of having outbreaks of infectious diseases.
Yeah, that's correct, Jamal. And the problem was that even before this blockade and before the bombings of Yemen, it's medical and health infrastructure were already fragile. Children in general outside of the large, urban areas were not really getting much access to medical care anyways. It already was the second poorest country, in the world. So adding insult to injury, these bombings seem to be contributing to a kind of destruction of what little civil infrastructure was already in Yemen, creating even more mass chaos. And it seems like we never learn, because the policy is to bomb Yemen until what? We don't know, with the concept of bringing stability into the region.
Well, the other thing is we have to caution our listeners about the misinformation that is going on, because that's why I try to monitor different sources for news. You hear a story, and remember, you have now the largest media outlets working in the Middle East are either controlled by Saudi Arabia, like Al Arabiya and others, even though they broadcast out of Dubai and in the UAE, and then Al Jazeera. And you look at these stories, for example, one story about an airstrike, which I talked was reported by the Saudi-led coalition on a warehouse that supposedly had Houthi ammunition and weapons. And immediately after that, we learn that this was a warehouse for Oxfam in northern Yemen. They bombed an Oxfam warehouse with food, grain, medical supplies, and so forth. And so just this morning, I watched the Oxfam's Yemen country director. He was on BBC in Arabic, the BBC Arabic side. His name is Grace Omer. He called the attack on the warehouse in the city of Saada, which is a stronghold for the Houthis, an absolute outrage. I'm sorry, it's a she, Grace. And she said the coalition had been told, they notified the coalition about the location of the warehouse, and the Oxfam offices were located. That's in this high-tech world. I'm sure you can know where are. It reminds me of Gaza, and Lebanon.
Same.
When the United Nations will send a communique and say, hey, we're there. Here is our warehouse. We have a big UN.
Here's our coordinates.
Here's our coordinates, the flag. And yet they bombed it. And she said, that this was an absolute lie and outrage that they've to say that this was a Houthis location. They bombed their offices, warehouses that contained humanitarian supplies associated with the provision of clean water. So that's what they bombed. They bombed their clean water filtration facility that is operated by Oxfam, saying that it was a Houthi's stronghold.
Well, this is to your point, Jamal, and this is why it's so important to really pay attention to what you said. 95, 96, 98% of the media reports coming from Yemen are coming from either U.S.-backed or Saudi-backed news outlets. And to be able to get any kind of legitimate information from on the ground is you have to dig far. In addition to that, all of these media outlets, Jamal, are still speaking about the indigenous Houthis as rebels, as the, somehow they're from the outside, they're agitators, they're being sent there by Iran, and they're causing trouble. That is still the dominant narrative that we hear every single day hearing about anything in Yemen.
Yeah, that's right. So we'll keep following on this story. It's not going to go away. We've been talking about it actually for the past few weeks. I think it's gonna get worse.
Well, but here's the thing: we have to look at what just a second on that, because what is the outcome going to be? You're going to have Yemen, even before this, many people thought was already a failed state. Now that they've bombed what little infrastructure and civil society has been there, we have to remember that AQAP, ISIL, and some other groups hostile to, so many different, stakeholders in the world are just gaining a huge foothold in the region right now. The Saudis are going after the Houthis, but what they're not talking about is what's happening with AQAP, ISIL, and the other affiliate groups that are really taking root in Yemen right now, unlike any other time.
That's right. And as I mentioned earlier, this story is not going to go away, and we will be talking about it, and it's just... It's a terrible situation. The way I look at things, just briefly, every country that has been affected in the Middle East, most of them at least, Egypt, Iraq, Syria, now Yemen, those are kind of the ancient heritage and old civilizations of the Middle East, and they're getting destroyed as we are speaking. We're moving to another important story. That's also an ongoing. It's a very, very sad story because I felt this has been ongoing for what, few years at least. It has intensified in the past year and a half, which is the story of African migrants escaping poverty, turmoil, ethnic cleansing in certain cases. Trying to make it just into a better place, into Europe, and drowning in
it's
the
terrible.
Mediterranean.
It's terrible.
Including the last thing that happened where you have, in certain incidents, we have upward of 700-800 people dying in one trip. In one trip, imagine that. They've been exploited by... smugglers.
They've been exploited by smugglers, but at the same time, in the broader context, Jamal, we always have to ask our question: why are people trying to leave Africa, North Africa, and Eastern Africa? Why are people trying to leave Libya? Why are people trying to leave Syria? Why are people trying to leave? They're leaving because of the campaign of Western powers, the United States and to some extent Europeans, have been bombing their homes, and creating the most hostile, uninhabitable regions and creating such chaos and misery. So what would any natural human inclination be, Jamal, but to try to escape for your life, the life of your family? The smugglers take advantage of it. They take thousands of dollars from these individuals.
Traffickers.
And they stuff them like sardines into these boats that are not seaworthy many times. And then they get off the coast of Italy. And then it does. And this last story, Jamal, was really particularly, I think, as you said, really painful because the ship was stopped functioning. It was lost at sea. A sea tanker comes. The people on the boat think, oh, we're going to be rescued. They all go to one side of the boat, and then the boat capsizes. And there were hundreds of people underneath, downside, who, perished, almost instantly. The scenes that they described, Jamal, are just harrowing. And we have to ask ourselves this question. These policies that keep being engaged with in Libya and in Iraq and in Syria are causing this wave of people trying to save themselves. Where else are they going to go?
And the last incident you're talking about, I was reading about it, 950 people.
Unbelievable.
Were on board of a boat that is certified to carry...
What, 200?
Less than 200 people. 950 people. 700 of them disappeared. They were thrown into the sea as the boat capsized. So far, only
I think
something like less than 180 survivors
have been found.
Been found, and they've been basically pulling bodies from the water. I mean, can you imagine that 950 people on a boat that carries less than 200 people? What's going to happen to?
And it's not
going to.
And I think it's not going to stop, Jamal. I mean, part of what we've been speaking about on the show for years now is the large number of displaced, individuals, internally and externally displaced people, whether it's Palestine, Syria, Iraq, you know, or Libya right now, and throughout parts of Africa, there are literally millions of people who are displaced and are looking to have a better life.
Yeah, and up till last Sunday, the EU held an emergency meeting. This is the first time that the EU takes this situation seriously. I mean, in general, for the past couple of years, they've been in denial. And only countries that have been affected directly were trying to raise this issue because all the burden on these countries, like Italy. Italy, you know, because of the that's why people go to Libya and they try to cross into Italy, you know, in the southern Italy.
On some of the islands
and
there,
some of the islands like Malta and so forth. And now, for the first time, they say, hey, wait a minute, let's talk about this. So they had a meeting, the European Union met in Luxembourg to discuss the disasters, you know. And the big question is how many more people will have to drown until Europe finally acts. And the other thing that really bothers me about this story and what bothers me actually about journalists, the way some Western journalists, the way they've been reporting on this story, using the term illegal, you know, like, you know, those illegal immigrants, you know, or illegal African immigrants.
But they're calling them migrants.
But I'm just saying, there are migrant workers all over the world.
But they're refugees.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, even that, I'll accept that. But the term illegal.
I know.
I mean, this is when you put that terminology and label a person as illegal, this makes you look like a criminal. You're doing something, you know, you're illegal. This means you are doing something illegal. And how illegal is it for you
to save your life?
Save your life when you either attacked by militias or by your own government or dying from starvation. And instead of giving them a hand, they label them as illegal. And this is really troubling. And I listen to some of those reporters and the way actually they talk about them. And write about them instead of labeling them as just human beings trying to survive. But it is a major problem. And by the way, this does not, now the way it's been, now you find out about, you know, the real story behind all these refugees trying to leave, you know, their poor countries or the turmoil. It's not just about Africa. You know, I mean, you have, you know, from Northern Africa, you have people coming from Africa. You have people coming from Bangladesh, Afghanistan, Syria, of course. Syria is in the Middle East, in Asia, Iraq, Palestine, Gaza. People from Gaza, especially after the last Israeli attack on Gaza. Young people, you know, in Gaza, young people are lured by these smugglers,
right,
and they put their entire life savings and, you know, to get on a boat from Egypt to cross. Number one, it's a dangerous trip to get into Egypt, and then some of those Egyptian smugglers, in collaboration with whoever they're working with in the Mediterranean, get them to Alexandria, and they go in the middle of the night trying to make it into Europe or into places like Malta. Of course, Israel, those Africans who make it into Israel, they are held in what they call a detention center, which I call it more like a ghetto in Holot, right in the desert.
It's a prison.
In the prison. And the ones that they give them some work permits or just to get out, they come under attack by the population.
Right.
You could look that up on the video. They are attacked by the average Israeli citizen, beating them up, using, you know, racial slurs against them, you know, all kinds of things. So in fact, there was a story identifying some Ethiopians who made it into the Holod detention center and then later on were deported, or I don't know what happened exactly to them, but they wound up in Libya, and they were part of the group that got killed by ISIS in Libya.
That's right.
because you know, someone was able to identify these people. So this is, I mean, a major humanitarian crisis, including here. I mean, people read it, it's like so distant, you know.
It's not distant.
And you're thinking, you know, I mean, aside from all the conflicts, the war in Yemen, the aftermath of the so-called Arab Spring, all the killing that is going on in Iraq and in Syria, and these people are drowning in the sea or getting killed on their way to Europe.
Well, Jamal, I think you're right. This problem is not going to go away. And my ongoing question to our listeners and to the pundits who call them illegal or calling them migrants is, you destroy their country, you create uninhabitable conditions for them. Nobody wants to leave their country unless the situation becomes intolerable, unsafe, and you want to leave to protect yourself and your family. And yet, these countries, whether it's European countries, the United States, whatever, has turned their back on the very people that need their help right now. And I'm in agreement with you. I think it's going to get much, much worse. There are so many people in Libya and in Africa right now that are going to keep going, Jamal. I mean, they're still, even though the risks are so great, they're still going to go.
That's right. So another story we'll talk about before we take a break and then come back and talk
to
you about
your
trip.
Yeah, and I want to talk about a couple of things. I want to ask your opinion about extrajudicial assassination. But not just anyone, Jamal. I want to ask your opinion about what you feel are the legal, ethical, moral implications of extrajudicial assassination of American citizens. Because breaking news today, three American citizens were extrajudicially assassinated and murdered in Pakistan by the Obama drone program. And an Italian, a fourth person, was also killed, murdered in this drone attack in Pakistan. And first time, I mean, this is kind of interesting. Obama took he says, I take full responsibility. And even his press secretary said, maybe we need to rethink our drone program. I think most people aren't even awake, Jamal, at the profound implications of what it means for an American citizen to be killed and assassinated by their own government without any kind of judicial process. It's kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal, but I also want to explore the extrajudicial concept itself versus this particular attack and the way President Obama talked about it and the government. And for our listeners, probably it's helpful to, if you haven't read about this story, but what happened is we have one of the victims. He's a doctor, Warren Weinstein. He's 73-year-old, and he was an American aid worker taken hostage by Al-Qaeda, supposedly, in 2011.
Right.
So that's one. The other person is Giovanni Loporto, who's an Italian, and he was also captured by a so-called terrorist group. It has not been identified, so if I don't know which one in particular, it's Al-Qaeda or somebody else, in 2012. And so in an interview, and this is kind of unprecedented because that President Obama, I think, answered that question, you know, that the White House, in fact, represented by the president, acknowledged conducting an operation. That's what you're talking about, the drone attack. And they said it wasn't aware the hostages were present at the time. So that's why I'm just taking that story versus the extrajudicial, because extrajudicial is Al-Awaliqi, who is an American citizen in Yemen, or an American of Yemeni origin, that the Obama administration deliberately targeted him. They went after him.
But there were two that were targeted.
Without bringing him into trial, etc.
Right, but there were two other Americans there, Jamal.
Yeah, but this one, I'm just saying, this particular incident, to you know, that the White House acknowledged conducting the operation. And they say that they were not aware that the hostages were present.
Then they shouldn't have sent the drone.
Another American allegedly to have become an Al-Qaeda leader, Ahmed Farouk, his name, was also killed in the drone attack. So they were probably targeting Ahmed Farouk, who is an American, and that's, yeah, that applies.
But Adam Gadan was also there and killed, and he's an American citizen.
Yeah, so I'm looking at all the details. So speaking from the White House, a grim-faced Obama, because I don't know what excuse they have about the Italian. You know, grim-faced Obama took responsibility for the U.S. drone strike and expressed his condolences to the families of the slain humanitarians. So those humanitarian workers, and this is a quote from him saying, "Based on information and intelligence we have obtained, we believe a U.S. counterterrorism operation targeting an Al-Qaeda compound accidentally." That's what they say. He just accidentally killed Warren and Giovanni. That's the Italian.
Okay, but
and the American. And then he adds to that the cliche fog of war.
Bogus.
Excuse. He said.
Bogus.
He said it's cruel and bitter truth that in the fog of war, generally, and our fight against terrorists specifically, mistakes, sometimes deadly mistakes, can occur.
Jamal, the fog of war is when you're on the ground and literally there's a fog. Whether it's a physical fog or a mental fog or whatever. There's no fog of war when there is a drone, however far away, monitoring the site. They had this site, Jamal, what they didn't tell you, monitored for almost a year, the comings and goings. They're trying to tell the public that they knew who was there, they monitored it, and the general policy with drones is that unless you know exactly who's there, you don't pull the trigger.
Well, they pulled the trigger, they're acknowledging the mistake. Now, talking about Yemen, and it was a U.S. drone strike in Yemen nearly 4 years ago that killed ex-Long Islander Samir Khan, who left the U.S. and later became editor of the Al-Qaeda magazine Inspire,
right.
And was not a target of the strike, by the way. This guy just like went there to work. He was riding in the same car as alleged Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula leader Anwar al-Awaliki, also an American who was in the intended target. So the big question about...
By the way, they killed his son, too.
Extrajudicial, yeah. The extrajudicial, statement that you've made, which is very accurate, which basically says that, how can the government target one of its citizens, a U.S. citizen, kill him without bringing him into trial, without
charging him,
without him having his day in court? That's a clear extrajudicial. That's a clear extrajudicial because you are killing an American citizen. You are not, accidentally, let's say, getting into a gunfight with some robbers of a bank and the robber dies in the process. You know where these people are found, and then you're targeting, which is they've been doing this targeting.
But look, Jamal, my feeling is, if you know where the person is, and this has always been my argument against, the brutal Israeli extrajudicial assassination program that they've been waging against Palestinians. So it seems like the Americans are borrowing from the Israeli playbook. If you know exactly where somebody is, know well enough where somebody is that you can target a drone, why wouldn't you go in there, arrest them according to our Constitution, charge them?
Because, and I'll stop you here, because I have the answer for that. And
you think you have the answer.
And it is not the answer you'll like to hear. I don't like to hear this answer. But at least the legal answer is because of September 11. And since September 11, there is the 2001 Authorization to Use Military Force Act, AUMF.
Which
was enacted because of September 11, which gives the president sweeping powers. And that's why, the president, because that's his decision, sweeping powers I don't have all the detail of the axe, but you could, I'm sure if you guys...
No, I've read it.
It. Well, our listeners, gives him sweeping powers to either detain or kill what they put it under. You become an enemy combatant. So if you're an American citizen, or kill enemy combatants without approval from Congress, without going through due process.
Wait a minute.
The government, listen, the government has invoked the AUMF to justify drone strikes in countries where America isn't actually at war. We're technically not at war in Yemen. They've been killing people left and right.
And we're not at war in Pakistan.
And so you're right about this, what you mentioned earlier as another victim in this process, a teenager, Al-Awaliq's 16-year-old son, Abdurrahman, also he was born in this country, an American citizen, was killed in a separate drone strike 2 weeks after his father was taken out.
What did he do?
I don't know.
Well, see, here's my thing. We will have a long discussion about this, but many people, and I think most legal scholars...
We need a legal scholar because...
We will.
Neither
one of us, but some people would argue, as I would, that it's unconstitutional. You can make all the laws you want.
The Patriot Act is unconstitutional, but nevertheless, they created the Patriot Act, and President Obama renewed the Patriot Act.
So we would challenge, and we're going to find a legal scholar on this, challenge the AUMF's constitutional tweaking in order to kill American citizens. Okay? So my feeling is this is a slippery slope. You know, this is slated to be renewed within 2 weeks, Jamal, the AUMF and the Patriot Act and things like that.
Probably gets renewed.
And
you know,
we will see Obama's waxing poetic about how apologetic he is. But the problem is that people are getting killed by drones every day. Whether or not, and Americans are now getting killed by drones. When will it stop? When will we have a constitutional challenge? If you know where they are, pick them up. That's what I say.
So last but not least, a quick story before we go to our break and then talk about Cuba is it's heating up at the Gaza now borders because, according to Israeli media, after 4 months of quiet, a rocket was fired on Thursday evening from Gaza towards communities in southern Israel.
I don't think it's been quiet. We just haven't been talking.
So now things, it looks like, you know, something might happen. I don't know if there's going to be a retaliation, but also yesterday Israel celebrated its 67-year
occupation
of Palestine or Independence Day, and as the Palestinians call it, Nakba, the Nakba Day, with festivities, dances, etc. You know,
Israeli hummus.
Repeat. You know, shown in the news, whitewashing. It's ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and indigenous people, and the creation of basically an apartheid wall with the state. So anyway, that passed yesterday. We probably will be talking about this next week, because even though Nakba Day and Independence
Day, it's not till May 15th, really.
They are the same day, but they don't come on the same day. I think they come on the same day every 19 years, Jess, and that's because Israel follows the old Jewish calendar, which is the lunar.
Right.
And we have Palestinians, it's the Gregorian calendars. It's set on May 15th. So every 19 years, actually, they come on the same day.
Well, I guess we're going to have to wait a few years on that. We're going to take a short musical break. This is KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM, and this is Arab Talk. We'll be right back. This is Arab Talk on KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM.
So Arab Talk was in Cuba. I mean, we can take credit for your trip just to Cuba.
Did you fund it, Jamal? Is that what you're saying?
I didn't fund it. Maybe Raul Castro funded it.
No.
I know you went on a humanitarian and medical
mission
to right. Cuba. But actually, this is great because we would like to go to Cuba and broadcast maybe from Cuba at some point. And I don't know how long this is going to last, or at least you went and saw Cuba the way it's supposed to be, because soon
Taco Bell, Kentucky Fried
McDonald's
Chicken,
and McDonald's. There'll be a Starbucks on every corner.
Verizon.
So those who have the opportunity to go, we recommend they go now before it gets all ruined.
It would be
by the American influence, and I'm sure it reminds me of scenes from The Godfather. I'm sure some exactly. people would like to bring Las Vegas back into Cuba and the
casinos way it used to be, yeah.
and the way it used to be a playground for Americans. So first tell us about what was the purpose of your trip.
Well, I've been doing these projects, as you know, Jamal, for many years, these medical humanitarian missions, many places. And as it turns out, Cuba has probably one of the best medical schools in the world. It's the Latin American School of Medicine, and they train probably about 800 to 1,200, graduate 800 to 1,200 new doctors every year. Now, what a lot of people don't know about this situation, and what I find just amazing, two things about this program. The physicians that graduate from the Latin American School of Medicine end up going all over the world providing humanitarian and free medical care all over the world. And these are amazing doctors, Jamal, because not only do they provide medical care during the day, then by night they teach literacy to communities, disadvantaged communities all over Central, South, and Latin America. It's an extraordinary way to think about being a doctor. It's an extraordinary way to promote health and intellectual development and cognitive development. And I'd have to say, I wish where I worked and the medical schools all over the United States would take a cue and teach doctors not just to be doctors, but to do, a more comprehensive way of engaging communities who are really struggling.
I don't know about the volunteering and the humanitarian aspect, but there is a major, gap being a doctor here, financial gap, and the rest of the world. Because if you're a doctor in the Middle East or another place, you make a good living, but nothing like what you'll make in this country and how much healthcare, despite the whole now the Obamacare and whatever. So,
but doctors in Cuba don't make any more money than anybody else in Cuba, Jamal. That's
no,
what you
I
need
mean,
to.
Yeah, they have a profession, but even in other countries, like I said, you can make a decent living.
Not in Cuba.
But you're not going to be making $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 a year being a doctor in the U.S. And then also, I don't know how much that plays a factor of how much debt you leave your medical school, because education is free, right, in Cuba?
It's all free.
So you don't come out, and also the liability insurance.
Yeah. Well, here's some interesting facts about Cuba, Jamal. The infant mortality rate is lower in Cuba than it is in the United States.
I didn't know that.
Which is really rather striking when you think about it in terms of the discrepancies in terms of, technologies and infrastructure and everything. The infant mortality rates, the prenatal care that Cubans get is far superior. What women in Cuba get in terms of prenatal care and postnatal care is unrivaled, I think, anywhere in the world, to be honest. And the infant mortality rate is very low. Health care is free, as you know. And then let's say you live in a rural area and you're not near any kind of clinic or anything like that. The doctors and the nurses go to you. Mm-hmm. So the ability to really engage what I would call community medicine, community engaged medicine, to really see medicine not as a privilege as we do here in the United States, but as a human right, as an inalienable right, as a right of every individual to have access to. That's the way medicine is practiced in Cuba. And from that perspective, it's a model that obviously I feel very, very strongly about. And it's just so ironic how the wealthiest country in the world has a higher infant mortality rate than Cuba, and how we still have in this country, Jamal, millions of people who go to bed hungry every night and millions of people every single night who go to bed sick without health insurance. Mm-hmm. And that just does not happen in Cuba.
Mm-hmm. So how was the reaction from your hosts there, receiving you, receiving a delegation from the United States?
Well, I would say, besides all the hype, in terms of what we've been hearing in terms of the media and our government's hype about, the last 50 years, people in Cuba are amazing, amazing, amazing human beings in general. And I can tell you that if I were to go to a community like reception, I would stand on one side of me would be, say, someone who is responsible for keeping the community clean, say a street sweeper, for example, for lack of a better term. That would be on my left. And on my right would be a Supreme Court Justice of Cuba. And in terms of that's the way Cuban society is structured, is that the class differences that we see here that really dominate our society here, they are not prevalent in any shape, way, or form in Cuba. The other thing that is really remarkable, although as everywhere in the world, a kind of racism does pervade wherever you go, anywhere in the world, in Cuba you see the lack of kind of structural racism the way we have here. So it's very remarkable to see Afro-Cubanos at the highest levels of government. And, yeah, you want to say something about that.
Here's some information, and actual information to our listeners, because I don't know if this great Cuban artist. While you were in Cuba, I was listening to Afro-Cubano jazz music.
Which is awesome.
This past Sunday, Omar Sosa.
Awesome.
Omar Sosa. Performed at Yoshi's.
Yeah,
so
awesome.
I went this past Sunday, and I had the privilege of listening to him. So I don't know if he's still there, but people who can't make it there, can buy his record. But that was actually a great performance.
Yeah, and I don't want to, the blockade of Cuba for the last 50-plus years has had a devastating impact on the Cuban economy. There's no doubt
obviously,
about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it obviously have. And I do want to say that to a person, almost every Cubano that I spoke with is very excited about the possibility of having a better relationship with Americans. Not the American government, obviously.
On the other hand, I mean, you mentioned it because almost like every person that we've known who traveled to Cuba who is not from the United States, Cuba is not as isolated as we tend to think. I mean, people vacation in Cuba, they come all the way from France and Europe and other countries.
It's true, but in terms of a trading partner, that the United States exercises a kind of economic and transactional economic blockade on Cuba that does make the access to dollars, which is the international mm-hmm. currency, to do business in, you can't use your Visa card down there still. You can't use credit cards.
Oh, you can't?
No,
So what, you use cash?
You have to use cash.
Dollars?
You can't use legally, you can't use dollars.
So you have to change the dollar
into Cuban money.
What's the trading value?
I didn't pay attention because I wasn't spending.
you were in a group.
Yeah, but they let you exchange some dollars for Cuban dollars. And of course, there's a black market for dollars there and everything. But typically, if you're seeing, it's seen as not terribly good thing to be flashing dollars anywhere in Havana.
And here's the crazy thing. I mean, we're talking about a country just 110 miles off the coast of Florida.
It's nothing.
That you have the United States since the 60s has maintained this relationship.
Yeah, I do want to say something, though, that our listeners may be surprised about, Jamal.
What is that?
A very, very, very large, vibrant Arab community.
That's why Arab Talk
in Cuba
is very interested. Arab Talk, meaning you, me, and Ashley. And Ashley wants to go.
We're going to have a trip. We're going to have an Arab Talk trip to Cuba.
To Cuba, and maybe we'll get to record something in one of their radio stations
there. Here's the thing. There is a vibrant, well-integrated Arab, Middle East, North African community or communities in Cuba and in Havana. There's a large Palestinian community. There's a large Syrian community. There's a large North African community. And unlike here, with all the Islamophobes and all of the hostility that's being directed toward our communities, you don't see that in Cuba. You see a very vibrant, rich kind of intermixing, if you will, mm-hmm. of our cultural heritage, our language, our food, everything, and kind of mixing and blending with indigenous Cuban society in a way that's really, really beautiful and just magnificent to see. There's an Arab cultural center in Havana. There's a Palestinian community center in Havana. And I have to tell you, they're not just well-respected in general in Cuban society, but leaders in business, leaders in education, and leaders in the government. So it's pretty amazing.
And we were talking outside, the Cuban government actually offers scholarships to Palestinians.
Yeah, every year the Cuban government and the Latin American School of Medicine offer large numbers of free scholarships, so Palestinians and people from other, you know, Arabs from other Arab countries come to Cuba and learn and study medicine or their residencies and get advanced training
right.
in Cuba, all expenses paid. And you and I have had lots of exposure to like the medical system in Palestine and in other Arab countries. People will generally say that the best trained Arab doctors are from Cuba.
Well, here is a factoid. You probably know it. But Cuba has the third highest number of physicians per capita
in the world.
In the world, behind only two. And actually, those are countries I'm sure you went to, and one that you've recently went to, Monaco. that's before, and Qatar, which you've been to.
Yeah.
So behind only Monaco and Qatar, Cuba has the third highest number of physicians per capita. They're even used as an export. But you're talking about they have so many physicians, so they have so many doctors that they travel to places like Venezuela. So Venezuela pays $5.5 billion a year for the almost 40,000 Cuban medical professionals who now make up half of its health care personnel. So they export it to Venezuela.
And by the way, Venezuela pays them in oil. So it's kind of in part, not in total, but they send oil to Cuba.
But that's how, you know, and also they send money back. But this is one of the results of the embargo. For example, Cuban doctors lack access to most American pharmaceutical products and, importantly, to a third-generation antibiotics. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, this is a humanitarian thing. We're not talking about...
No, it's
the embargo.
It's really disturbing at many different levels, and, in fact, that's exactly what the embargo has done. And I would say, despite that, the average health... I mean, you don't see obesity in Cuba the way you see obesity here. You see the management of chronic illness in Cuba.
It's due to the cigar.
I don't know.
Probably.
If it's due to the... I don't know if it's due to the cigar.
That's the only thing.
But, you know, there's a tragedy in all of this is that, it's clear that, in general, Cubans are suffering. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And there's a lot of complex factors going into why. And it... I mean, I guess this is one of the few things that Obama said recently that did make sense. He said, well, 50 years of a policy that has not worked.
Not worked, of course.
Let's try something else.
So how did you go there? How did you flew where to?
It's a long, complicated, circuitous way, but you go through, Mexico City, Cancun, Havana.
And then when you come back... You have the Cuban stamp on your passport.
No, no Cuban stamp.
So there's no. They know that not to stamp. So anyway, obviously they figure out that you came back from Cuba here. And
no, there's. I mean, you know, they have relaxed the. They've relaxed
so
the.
So they don't say anything.
No.
Have you been? You say Cuba.
Yeah,
and
of course.
Say, welcome back.
Under the Obama administration, especially more recently, they have relaxed the travel restrictions.
So if I go there.
You can use your U.S.
Question,
you can
where
use
you've been. I say Cuba. They're not going to pull me to VIP room.
They
to
might
ask me.
They might
500
pull,
questions.
They might pull you, but in general, For no, they won't. I mean, it's if you have to go in one of like six or seven categories of some kind of intellectual exchange,
journalistic
exchange, medical exchange.
I'm going.
Educational exchange.
This is on the agenda, baby. I mean, and I think Cuba, it's so close here, and I've been countries like Libya and you know, Syria through all the conflicts. For me, that will be a vacation, going to Cuba.
Well, I think what you're going to find is a culture and a community and a history that is very very much like ours, Jamal, in terms of its hospitality and its
good
history.
Food.
Awesome, fantastic food.
So on that note, you've whetted our appetite to
it's
go.
It's time to go.
To
Vamanos.
Cuba. And by the way, you've beat the Pope. The Pope, he's going to Cuba in September.
Well, maybe I'll see him there.
So you've been listening to Arab Talk on KPOO San Francisco. This is 89.5 FM.